Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know, looking at it again now in the studio, the news of the day seems, what, familiar? The BP oil spill, a housing crisis, Facebook? It's weird. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 15th of October. And now, 2.5 years on, there is some closure today in the Deepwater Horizon Gulf oil spill. BP is going to pay $1.3 billion in criminal penalties for the biggest oil spill this country has ever seen. It's part of an overall settlement of $4.5 billion for the disaster that left 11 workers dead. The Justice Department has also charged two BP employees with manslaughter. So at the end of the day, we have individuals and a company charged as criminals, which means what exactly? Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff sorts it out.
We all know what happens to humans who are criminals, but what about a company?
There is nobody to kick or to throw in prison when you're talking about a corporation.
David Skeel is a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania. He says corporations have personalities and cultures just like people, and a criminal conviction sends a message.
We're saying that that corporate culture, that corporate personality has acted in a way that we believe to be criminal.
BP has agreed to plead guilty to 11 felony counts of misconduct and one of obstruction of Congress. Some convicted corporate felons have been banned from doing business with the federal government. Blaine Lassen of Loyola Law School in New Orleans says criminal charges are about deterrence.
The most effective way to do that against a corporation, of course, is to hurt its bottom line by requiring them to pay a criminal penalty that is going to be meaningful in financial terms.
The $4 billion is less than BP's profits last quarter. But Abram Lustgarten, who covers BP for ProPublica, says pending civil cases could drain more than $20 billion from BP.
The most important cases are yet to be resolved.
And prison isn't out of the question. The Justice Department has charged three BP employees on counts ranging from manslaughter to obstruction of Congress. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
All right, on now to everybody's favorite story, at least around here, the fiscal cliff and what will happen when and to whom. Some things we do know. Come January 1st, if there is no deal, taxes would go up. There would be automatic spending cuts. Recession would soon follow, in theory. But what about a more likely reality, that on New Year's Day, taxes do go up, that there are automatic spending cuts? And then, maybe, what, 2 weeks later, Congress and the White House say, never mind, we actually have a deal. What would those 2 weeks be like, and what effect would they have on the economy? From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura has that story.
So you run a government agency. It's New Year's Day. Okay, it's actually January 2nd. The government's closed on New Year's, and there's no deal.
So you slam the brakes on any spending.
That's Nicholas Bloom, an economics professor at Stanford. You freeze payroll, adjust your budget, but if Congress and the White House were to reverse course 2 weeks later...
At that point, you put your foot on the accelerator, and that extreme stop-start is very damaging.
And it's hard. Alice Rivlin is a former White House budget director. Now she's working with a campaign called Fix the Debt. The government is big, and it's not nimble.
Some programs have large lead times and involve major contracts, and those are very difficult to change quickly.
And it could be a logistical nightmare for the private sector and corporate accountants if taxes went up, then down again 2 weeks later. And consumers would be spooked. Andrew Bush with BMO Capital Markets says we'd live in fear, worried there's another fiscal crisis right around the corner.
It's really hard to make decisions on whether to move to a new home if you don't know what your mortgage deduction is going to be like.
If the U.S. goes over the fiscal cliff, then claws its way back, what would the rest of the world think? Alice Rivlin says we'd have to ask ourselves this question.
Does this make our government look so incompetent that people are not going to want to invest in the United States?
And if the answer is yes, the effects of automatic austerity would last a lot longer than 2 weeks. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, there was a zig and a zag and then another zig. Details, numbers, you know the drill. Occupy Wall Street is back in something of a new form. No more actual occupying. The group has moved into the business of financial mechanics. The latest project is something called the Rolling Jubilee. Occupy activists raising money to buy bad consumer debt and then forgive it. Marketplace's Sally Herships explains.
Normally, when you hear Jubilee, you think Queen Elizabeth or wedding anniversary. But this Jubilee has biblical roots. It's right there in Leviticus 25:28.
It actually comes from thousands of years ago.
Kent Smetters teaches economics and public policy at Wharton.
During Old Testament times, where every 49 years, you had what's called a Sabbath of the Sabbaths.
It was known as the Jubilee, when the rich were expected to forgive the debt of the poor. But in this case, Occupy activists calling themselves Strike Debt are serving as middlemen. About a week and a half ago, the group started fundraising online.
We've had to use credit cards and debt
to make ends meet.
Bad medical and credit card debt is regularly bundled and sold as securities, just like the subprime mortgages that triggered the financial collapse. The Rolling Jubilee has been buying this debt from brokers for pennies on the dollar, and then it simply doesn't collect the money. The process is anonymous, but while the Jubilee doesn't know who it's helping, so far, the group says it's raised enough to pay off just under $4 million of IOUs. But consumer debt is in the billions.
We need a Jubilee, a clean slate, a cancellation of debts for the 99%.
Wharton's Kent Smetters knows about the biblical origins of the Jubilee because he's the son of a small-town pastor, which is also why he says he grew up under the poverty line. He thinks debt can play an important role in the economy, and that the Jubilee, the modern version, could pose a moral hazard.
So if this program were actually the law of the land, I would have never gotten out of poverty, because no bank in their right mind would have lent me money.
Smetter says if people know they don't have to pay back debts, because projects like the Rolling Jubilee will bail them out, they won't. So I asked Laura Hanna, an organizer with the Jubilee, if she's worried about that. She answered with some questions of her own.
I guess that I would ask whether our financial market makes any sense for the majority of the population at this point. The question becomes, why are we in so much personal debt?
Anna says the Jubilee knows it can't wipe out all debt. But one of the aims of the project is to start a conversation about why people take on debt and who they owe. In the meantime, she says, even paying off old debt worth only 5 cents on the dollar will make some difference.
So the point is that the project is both real and symbolic.
The Rolling Jubilee is holding a fundraiser tonight in New York. Tickets are sold out, but hopefully not on credit cards. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
There's news today of corporate raider Carl Icahn, not another hostile takeover or leveraged buyout. It is decidedly more humanitarian and philanthropic. Mr. Icahn is going to give the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City $200 million, and in return, they're going to put his name on the building. It is not, as you might imagine, a transaction that happens quickly. Dr. Kenneth Davis is the president and CEO of the Mount Sinai Medical Center, which includes the medical school. Dr. Davis, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
First of all, congratulations, I suppose, are in order. But at the same time, this was no overnight thing. You've been working with Mr. Icahn for quite a while on this.
Yes, Carl and I have met for 8 or 9 years. My role was not to convince him to be a generous man, which he is. My role was to convince him that Mount Sinai and medical research was a worthy project.
I suppose there comes a point where you have to move beyond generalities and start talking specifics. I mean, you have to talk about dollar amounts and names on buildings and what exactly the result of all this will be.
Well, right. I mean, Carl and I began to talk about naming the medical school, and what we had to do is reach an agreement around how that would be formulated. He had IRS issues that he had to work through. We had some concerns that we would have, but ultimately all the parties were able to get together.
The thing about money in this society is people get really squishy when you start talking about it. Was there any of that with Mr. Icahn and you guys?
You know, that's his life, money. I mean, Carl's very effective in earning it and using it so effectively in the work that he does. So, no, we were never uneasy really talking about dollars and amounts.
What happens next? I mean, other than hiring new sign painters, I imagine. I mean, there's a lot that has to happen to implement this gift.
Well, yeah. I mean, on the operational level, we've got to change all our stationery over time.
That's right.
But, I mean, more importantly, we have to do the work of using the money effectively.
When you were in medical school, did you ever think you'd wind up doing this for a living?
No. I was in medical school at Mount Sinai. And as I left the signing ceremony with Carl, I thought how incredible it is that I've just changed the name of the medical school I went to. And how would I refer to that medical school going forward? Did I go to the Mount Sinai School of Medicine or the Carl Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai?
That's a pretty good problem to have, though.
Yeah, it's a good problem to have.
Dr. Kenneth Davis, he is the president and CEO of the Mount Sinai Medical Center, wherein you will soon find the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Dr. Davis, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Coming up, internet radio is not all about the airtime, you know.
We noticed that we had been paid 21 cents for those plays in total.
But first, let's do the numbers. All right, so that last zag on Wall Street today, it was down. The Dow Industrial's off 28 points, 0.2%, closed at 12,542. The NASDAQ gave back 9 points, 0.3%, finished at 2836. The S&P 500 shed 2 points, 0.1%. Closed at 1353. The fiscal cliff continues to weigh on share prices as more CEOs plead for a political compromise. The latest was Walmart's boss today, but he has more immediate challenges. Walmart's shares sank 3.6% as the discount retailer reported disappointing sales in the U.S. and China. Meantime, Target beat earnings estimates. Shares rose 1.7% today. Apple, once seen as a $1,000 stock, fell 2%, edged closer to $500 a share today. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. It'll be all eyes on Tennessee for earnings from the restaurant chain Cracker Barrel, headquartered in the state. And we'll hear from utility company, the Tennessee Valley Authority. Tomorrow's also the much-anticipated meeting between President Obama and leaders of Congress to talk about the so-called fiscal cliff. And 105 years ago today, Oklahoma became the 46th state. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. You know how sometimes I come on your radio and I remind you that the excesses of the financial crisis aren't completely behind us? This is one of those times. There's a big report due out by tomorrow in Washington about the Federal Housing Administration. The FHA is a force in the American mortgage market, and the report is expected to show some serious problems, as Marketplace's Mark Garrison tells us.
First, let's get one thing straight. The FHA is not Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. They buy up existing mortgages. Think of the FHA as an insurance company built to encourage lending to riskier home buyers. USC public policy professor Rafael Bostic is a former HUD assistant secretary.
FHA has historically been an entree for a bunch of first-time home buyers to get access into home ownership. It's been very important for ethnic minorities.
When people don't have the big savings needed for a down payment, banks are less likely to lend. That's when the FHA steps in, offering insurance and paying up if home loans go bad. And many have. The fear is the FHA doesn't have enough stashed away.
Do they, in fact, have enough reserves to meet future needs when a certain number of these mortgages will, in fact, go belly up and the lender comes to them for potential losses?
Christopher Thornburg with Beacon Economics is skeptical of the government boosting home ownership, but that's a cherished concept with bipartisan support, so there could be political will to help the FHA if it's drowning. Eric Belsky, managing director of Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies, believes a weakened FHA would affect the housing recovery.
This would, I think, take some steam out of it. Some borrowers that would otherwise have been able to get a loan wouldn't be able to.
If the FHA audit is as bad as some fear, we may not have seen the last housing crisis bailout. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
China's Communist Party Congress ended today exactly the way everybody thought it would end, with a public unveiling of the Politburo Standing Committee, the seven men who are going to run the world's second biggest economy. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports that Xi Jinping and his colleagues have their hands full.
Slower growth, an economy dangerously dependent on building infrastructure, and a widening gap between the rich and poor. China's new leaders will be judged on how well they handle these outstanding problems. But there's good news.
The direction that China needs to take, more market openness, a more balanced economy, all of those are in sync with what the United States wants from China.
Patrick Chovanec is a professor at Tsinghua University's School of Economics and Management.
If China moves away from this dependence on running surpluses, accumulating reserves, things that may boost growth but aren't necessarily sustainable, and shifts more to a more balanced economy, that actually creates demand for American goods, creates jobs in the United States.
He says the challenge is that it'll take a lot of political capital to make those changes. Qian Liu of the Economist Intelligence Unit in Beijing has hope in China's new rulers.
There is a combination of somewhat conservative and liberal embraces of these reforms, especially Xi himself.
Xi Jinping was governor of Fujian province and party secretary of Zhejiang province, two of China's richest regions. In both jobs, he pushed forward economic reforms that fostered more competition in the marketplace. The question is how much of this model he'll be able to copy and paste onto the rest of China. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
California, the land of ballot initiatives and voter referenda, had a bunch of them this time around. We've raised taxes to pay for schools, we've fixed our three strikes law, and in Los Angeles County, we have decided that condoms are the way to go. There's a new law here now that says porn actors have to wear them in scenes where they are called for. The industry says it's going to sue or move out of town if it has to. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has that story.
Just like cheesy music, the San Fernando Valley is identified with porn. But the adult film industry may relocate rather than implement the new condom regulations. Porn star Jessica Drake says a move would cause economic pain for everyone involved.
I think that this could have a negative financial impact on the adult industry, but I really do think that it can take money out of Los Angeles County, out of California as well.
Porn studio owners say they'll leave town before they allow prophylactics to get in the way of sales. Diane Duke is CEO of the Free Speech Coalition, the trade association for the porn industry.
If the courts don't decide in our favor, then the other option is for producers to film elsewhere, and they will.
Larry Flint is looking at Hawaii and Mexico, actually, even looking at moving out of the country.
Duke says producers already shoot lots of adult movies in Florida, Arizona, and Nevada.
We've had people from other states and other areas say, we would like to have you here. People want our business. We're great neighbors. We pay taxes. We pay living wages.
But locally, the porn industry isn't getting much love from its neighbors. Officials in Pasadena and Long Beach both said thanks, but no thanks. The spokesman for the city of Vernon told me that the adult film industry probably wouldn't be a good fit because his city is too industrial. That's right, Vernon says it's too dirty for porn. One voice running counter to this not-in-my-backyard mentality comes from the industry's backyard. Stuart Waldman is president of the Valley Industry and Commerce Association, which represents business in the San Fernando Valley.
This is an industry that creates over 10,000 direct and indirect jobs in a given year. It's an industry that pumps over $1 billion into our economy.
And the San Fernando Valley porn industry supplies its more glamorous neighbor with a steady supply of labor. Again, Diane Duke.
We've been able to support mainstream entertainment and mainstream Hollywood. When they have lulls, we're able to help out and hire some of those folks. A lot of people work in both industries.
Gophers, gaffers, and grips from mainstream movies can moonlight in porn. You won't find as many makeup artists in, say, Tampa. That's one of the reasons some observers say the industry isn't very likely to move. Talk to the contrary, they suggest, is just a tease. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
It's tempting to file this one under the What Else Is New tab. Facebook has a new app out. But hang on, because this one's not for playing farmer or remembering birthdays. It's a job app. So now, when you're done looking at pictures of last night's party and writing a status update about how crazy you got, you can go look at jobs listings. Yeah, what could possibly go wrong? Marketplace's Eve Troe explains.
This, of course, is not just about Facebook helping you find a job.
Their goal is to keep you in their ecosystem for as many things as they can, whether it's connecting with friends, playing games, and now looking for a job.
Clark Fredrickson is a vice president at eMarketer. He says there is a snag.
You may see hesitancy from consumers to adopt Facebook in a professional setting.
Oh, you mean people may not want to like a possible future employer on the same site they just used to like the pussycat dolls? Yeah. But Fredrickson cites a study that shows more than a quarter of people looking for jobs in the U.S. say they do use Facebook for that.
It's not a taboo for everybody.
The app lists nearly 2 million jobs from several major sources. One is the Direct Employers Association. Digital strategist Heather Hoffman says the sheer number of users, a billion people, makes Facebook attractive to companies looking for talent.
What better place to have those jobs than on Facebook, where literally, you know, we're getting in front of the majority of the population.
That could also get in front of the current leader in online job networking, LinkedIn. Its stock dipped yesterday when Facebook announced the social jobs app. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Since high-speed internet became a thing and streaming music and video became the thing, the business of being a professional musician has become confusing at best. What was once a relatively straightforward transaction, you give me a couple of bucks, I give you my record, is now part of a complex algorithm that online music services like Spotify and Pandora use to figure out how much musicians ought to be paid. And by and large, it's not a whole lot. Singer and songwriter Damon Krukowski took on that fee structure in a story he wrote for the music magazine Pitchfork that he called Making Sense. That's with a C, not an S. Damon, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai.
Hey, do me a favor and tell me about your most recent royalty check, would you? Because that kind of crystallizes this whole thing.
Right. To take a one song example, this was our very first single that we played on when we were in a band called Galaxy 500, and we released a song called Tugboat. And some people are still listening to it, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
And on Pandora, for example, it was played 7,800 times in that first quarter of 2012.
Which is a lot of times.
Right? Yeah, it's a lot of times to spin a record, that's for sure, if that's what you're doing. And anyway, so we noticed that we had been paid 21 cents for those plays in total.
Wait, back it up. 21 cents for 7,800 plays of this song.
That's right. And there are three of us who wrote the song together, so we each cleared 7 cents.
Which is insane.
Well, I guess it depends on your attitude, how much you expect to make from your music. But if you look to it as a source of income, no, it's just ridiculous.
So here's kind of an existential question about this thing, right? Has the internet been bad for music, or has it just been bad for musicians who want to get paid for their music?
Well, as a music lover and as a fan, I rely on the internet in all kinds of ways. And I in fact, subscribe to Spotify. I'm a paid subscriber because the service is amazing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I am paying them for this incredible convenience.
This is probably not the time for me to tell you that I download the free version of Pandora and just deal with the ads.
Right. But I wouldn't say it's been bad for musicians by any means, because you know, your music goes everywhere now. What we used to worry about as musicians trying to survive in a business climate was distribution.
Yeah.
And that's not the issue at all anymore, because distribution is universal and instantaneous and free. And that is a dream that we couldn't have even conceived of.
So if you could rewrite this whole thing, Damon, how would you write it so that you got a living wage or an appropriate wage?
I actually really believe in the free share of information. I really wrote the article. Some people have interpreted it as an angry statement. I'm not angry at these services at all. As I said, I use them myself. The article was really about treating this as any replacement for what was traditionally thought of as an artist royalty. It's not. It's really equivalent to free access to the information, except someone is making an enormous profit, and it's not the musicians.
Damon Krukowski is part of a duo called Damon and Naomi. They used to have a band called Galaxy 500. We're talking to him about his royalty payments and an article he wrote in Pitchfork. Damon, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which perhaps you've heard about already, but that I want to mark here because it's really quite remarkable. As you've seen and heard elsewhere, there is fresh fighting between the Israelis and the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Rocket attacks, airstrikes, fears of an Israeli ground offensive, serious stuff, the whole deal. All, or most of which, anyway, is being live tweeted by the Israeli Defense Force. Check it out yourself. At IDF spokesperson is the Twitter handle. Not honestly sure what to make of that. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 28 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ gave back 9 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 shed 2 points, about 0.1%. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The acting managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. I'm Kai Rizdal. I do hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.